from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and I'm going to talk about I'm going to kind of switch gears. Had a little bit more of a domestic focus on the last STRAT. This one, I'm really going into the international side, and I'm really focusing on what I think has become a truly, truly major issue. You may have heard or seen something that was written about former NATO Ambassador Kurt Volker talking about the situation in Russia, talking about Putin's prospects, shall we say, across the board. But I'm really going to get into what is happening in Russia and also what is the possible, some would say, eventual collapse of the Russian military and the Putin regime. Something's been widely speculated talk about. I can tell you, I've been on the air many times, and we've talked about Putin's health and Putin's prospects and all this other stuff and the Russian economy falling apart. And after over 3 years of war with Ukraine, none of that seems to have happened. Just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean things haven't gotten a lot worse in Russia. And that's what I'm going to kind of touch on is basically setbacks, some would say horrendous setbacks that Russia has seen over the last few years, but particularly over the last couple of years. Here is a distinct possibility. If Putin's summer offensive in Ukraine fails this year, as it appears it almost assuredly will, then it almost guarantees that Russia won't be able to launch another type of offensive, at least anything close to this one, next year. Things aren't getting better for them on the ground. They are not getting a bunch more tanks. They are not getting a bunch more capable armor. In fact, what they're doing is they're pulling tanks and armor out of mothballs, and these are not very survivable platforms. Some of these things were built in the 60s, 70s. Some of them actually even go back to the 50s. These are death traps for the Russian soldiers that have to take those things onto the battlefield. So unless something enormous changes, for example, if China suddenly switches its tack and comes into the war on Russia's side in a major way, that would be something that would change everything. There's a distinct possibility that that Russia won't be able to pull something like this off next year. And if they can't pull this off, the question is, where will Putin be sitting in terms of regime survival in that situation? First off, let me kind of get into this. Putin's belief was that his military, that he had invested a lot of money in, was going to be able to take over Ukraine within a few weeks in February of 2022, and that it was going to be kind of a larger, more formal version of what he just accomplished about 8 years before in Crimea with his little Green Men invasion. All right. And I think he believed that, you know, with seeing the Russian forces rolling in, that Ukraine would simply collapse, that their military wouldn't be able to sustain the pressure, that their government just didn't have the wherewithal to stay, that they would flee, and that he would roll in and take over the country. At least that's pretty clear what he thought he was going to be able to do. It did not happen. The Ukrainian military, government, its entire society was not going to collapse. I detected that before the invasion. It was funny. I went on the air and people are like, you're being too optimistic. I go, no, it's not just the number of tanks you have. It's the resolve of your military. It's the resolve of your people to stand up to an enemy. And I said, that's what I was seeing in the Ukrainian people. And that's exactly what happened. And they were not going to roll over and allow the Russians to come in and take over. It just was not going to happen. And as you saw, President Zelensky and his government did not flee. They stayed there in Kyiv and they held the course. All right. They put up an amazing defense. Frankly, some of it was on the fly. Some of it was very innovative in terms of what they did. And Russia's deeply ingrained corruption over decades and decades, that sort of corruption that was basically, if I had to say, the cornerstone of Putin's regime was the degree of corruption in his regime. That level of corruption meant that the army couldn't deploy operationally into Ukraine. You know, essentially, for example, they were on exercises and the troops just had enough, they kept enough gas in their vehicles for the exercise. They're going to load them up on, at least what they thought was they're going to load them up on trains and trucks and send them back to bases where they came from. So what they did was they sold the excess gasoline in their tanks for vodka so they could have a good time. So when they were told to turn this direction and go into Ukraine, they went into Ukraine, and for a lot of them, they just simply ran out of gas. The other problem was that they were not changing out the tires on the vehicles like they were supposed to. You know, tires, when they're sitting out, particularly if it's sitting out in a large lot for years with the extreme weather changes and stuff in Russia, look, they're just basically going to start falling apart over time. I mean, that's just how tires are. When they turned around, they went into Russia. And again, these tires that have not been maintained fell apart. The vehicles, the armored vehicles, the tanks, again, had not been properly maintained. They went in there and all the jerry-rigged stuff that was just enough to get them through a three-day exercise in the field wasn't enough to get 300 kilometers down the road. And their tanks and armored vehicles and everything literally started to fall apart. And long story short, the great offensive movement just withered and stopped along the road. So that was what happened there. And that was a sign of things to come, because that was the Russian military. All right, that was a clear thing. Eventually, and the other thing too, is the Ukrainians, not only did they resist, and they did what was essentially what we call levy en masse, which is a whole society mobilized, and they went out there to resist, and they resisted very well. And then over time, that levy en masse thing became more formalized into the military. Now, one problem they had was conscription. They had some rather quaint ideas that they wouldn't conscript anybody. I think initially it was until the age of 27, and then it dropped to 25. And it was just, by any other standards around the world, it was somewhat ridiculous. And their idea was that somebody should come of age and have a chance to live a life before they went to the military. A very interesting thing, a very sort of, I'm going to say, coffee klatch concept, if you will, of somebody sitting around sipping a little coffee and going, oh, they need to have a chance to have a life and live and whatever it is, but it has nothing to do with national security or national defense. And they paid a price for that. And a lot of those people, they came of age. And for those who looked at it and they go, I don't know if I want to serve in the military, many of them just disappeared and they left Ukraine. And these are men probably of military age who should have been serving, who weren't serving. And they paid a price for that too. And they've been trying to fix that ever since. And according to the former head of NATO, they had made a lot of corrective action on that. And they seem to have kind of stabilize that thing. However, in the long run, in retrospect, I should say, Putin's plan was a complete bust. He was forced to leverage propaganda points, a lot of bluster. He did a lot of nuclear saber rattling and everything else to try and deter the West from supporting Ukraine too much. Although the West decided they were going to support Ukraine regardless, although it was a little kind of a slow start, it picked up a lot. And eventually they got more and more weapons that they needed. And the Russian people, generally speaking, throughout history, have been kind of used to suffering and setbacks. If you look at Russian history, they've had a lot of suffering and setbacks. All right. And so psychologically, culturally, they were kind of prepared for this stuff. They were kind of prepared, I think, psychologically for the impact that the sanctions had on Russian society as a whole. And I will say that some of this willingness to sustain deprivation, if you will, is kind of baked into the Russian psyche. However, at some point, even that runs its course. At some point, you go, is this really working? And if you look at Russia in World War I, very instructive that within about 3 years, some would say less, but certainly within 3 years, they completely had it. And they could not take the losses. Now, the losses in World War I with the horrendous onset of trench warfare and everything else was something that is difficult to imagine. Although, if you're looking at the losses of Russian troops on the front lines, it is in many ways similar to the tragic situation that Russian troops faced in World War I. I would say there's a lot of similarities there. Certainly, the tactics are horrible. These meat wave attacks where they rush into the enemy and they get killed. And some of the just a senseless slaughter and sacrifice of Russian troops for truly marginal gains. It does bring a corollary into that. And it brings a corollary into the time frame, which were a little over 3 years. Again, I go back to World War I. I look at it. I go, there does seem to be something that we can look at there. All right. Now, with the rallying of Western aid support for Ukraine, it became clear that Russia wasn't going to win. And frankly, if Russia doesn't win, in the end of the day, Putin loses. That's kind of how that works. And I saw a thing recently, a couple weeks ago, Forbes has said at the current rate of advance, Russia will take Ukraine in 89 years. It gives you an idea of this slow, ponderous pace of Russian offensive operations we're seeing this summer. something that I don't think they can't really sustain. They can't sustain into the winter, that's for sure. And the fall becomes very difficult because things start to get a little bit difficult in the weather department there. So they don't have a whole lot of time left, if you will. The war brought back a lot of things that we didn't think about. You know, with the war on terror, we looked at special operations. It was all swooping in and doing stuff. And we did a lot of, civil-military relations. A lot of things that were very, very different than big warfare. To say that the duration of most of the conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq was very different from what we experienced in Desert Storm is to put it lightly. And then we see this war where, you know, of course they've gone back to World War I trench warfare, but we did see armor. We saw large force maneuver. We saw airstrikes that eventually became hundreds of drones being used as airstrikes. We saw missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles being used. And now we're starting to see some rather, we also saw landmines come back into the fore. Landmines had been morally repugnant for a lot of people. And then now they realize, well, they may be morally repugnant, but they're really useful on the battlefield. And we saw sea mines coming back into it. We also saw the Russian Navy, much vaunted in the Black Sea, essentially defeated by Ukraine, which didn't even have a Navy. They were using drones. And so we saw this massive innovation thing with aerial drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, and then unmanned surface vehicles, sea drones, if you will, waterborne drones, causing phenomenal losses for the Russians on the water and in their ports. And now we're looking at what's happening with the Russian economy. And it's facing some significant challenges. The ongoing war has had tremendous impact. You know, the conflict is taking a toll on a very strained economy, a very sluggish growth, if there's growth at all, soaring prices, a lot of inflation, depletion of Russia's national wealth fund, rising inflation, as I mentioned already, also extremely high interest rates, which means that even if the Russians are out there saying, hey, we want to buy more weapons or buy more whatever, companies, private firms can't borrow money to start up operations to do that. And of course, they're also running the risk that if the Ukrainian intelligence forces or Ukrainian intelligence finds out that their special operations forces may target that facility for destruction. So a lot of trouble getting capital for them to even do stuff. So there's a distinct chance sometime, I don't know when, there's a distinct possibility of effective state bankruptcy, whether they want to say their country's bankrupt or not, that will be effective state bankruptcy. Analysts are predicting that if Russia isn't already in a recession, and I think there's a lot of good reasons to believe they are, and they have been for some time, they're going into a recession this year. And a recession in this context may be a nice way of saying a depression, if you're looking at all the different factors involved. And if you look at all the macroeconomic indicators and the second, third order effects of those macroeconomic indicators across the board, all of these things together would suggest a very precarious economic situation in Russia and for Putin and for Putin's regime. All right. 30,000, with this spring offensive, over 30,000 troops have died. I think it's actually somewhere between 30 to 50,000 troops have died since the beginning of May. That's an enormous amount. In the latter part of June, they went over, according to the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, Russian troop losses, manpower losses, killed. Most of them were killed and injured. And by injured, I mean injured enough that they don't return to the battlefield. Went over a million men. And even in Russia, which is kind of psychologically, I would say, prepared for this sort of horrendous thing, a million men cannot be ignored. All right. And if you look at the condition of those who have been disabled and going back to Russia, they're just simply not getting the support that they need in their society. So it's an embarrassment. Russia's so desperate for, even though they've been spending a lot of money recruiting, which they can't sustain forever, they're now going back to North Korea to try and get North Korean troops in there, up to 30,000 troops might be coming in sometime in later summer. But even that is going to be a huge problem. And by the way, those North Korean artillery pieces and everything else have been getting whacked by Ukrainian drones on a pretty regular basis. And those $400 drones are causing tremendous losses. Those first-person view battlefield drones causing tremendous losses across the board for Russia. And experts are looking at this. They're saying, look, the vehicles, they're Soviet-era vehicles that they've been using, these really old vehicles. They have nothing that can protect themselves against these drones. They're not very survivable on the battlefield. In fact, it's so bad that the Russians started strapping wood to these old vehicles, logs in some case, to provide some level of protection against these drones. Now, it isn't working, but they're so desperate, they'll try about anything to try and do that. You know, they've lost over 14,000, Russians have lost over 14,000 tanks, over 30,000 artillery pieces out there. It just underscores the situation and how much they're losing. 70% of the losses that they're facing are from drones. And when you look at this Zelensky and President Trump drone mega deal, there's a lot to be said there, because actually what's happened is now Ukraine has a overcapacity in drones. And they were caught a little bit off guard with how fast Russia went to the fiber optic wire-guided drones, which cannot be jammed, unlike other drones that can be jammed. But now Ukraine seems to be catching up pretty fast in that regard. Some other indicators we see: internal dissent being crushed. You're seeing the number of people that seem to fall out of high buildings or die under mysterious circumstances. That tells you that Putin is really worried about internal dissent within his country. You know, he saw what happened. He saw with Alexei Navalny, with the when there was this huge outpouring of memorializing his death, where he died in a Russian prison under very suspicious circumstances. And even though people can't protest per se, that was an indication of how deep they felt, because it was dangerous to go out there and show up and publicly eulogize Navalny, but a lot of people did nonetheless. There's reports that villages and towns and even urban neighborhoods are being patrolled by vigilante gangs or vigilante groups, because the security forces have been so depleted, leaving all these criminal gangs running roughshod over these areas, that now they've basically given up on central government. They've given up on the Russian state, and they're saying, we're going to do our own thing to protect our own people. It's rather amazing what we're seeing there. And we're also seeing Central Asian countries, which have always been very much in the Russian court, moving in a distinctly different direction. You know, a lot of these prisoners that were recruited by the Russian military and by the Wagner group, the mercenaries, and offered, you know, you will get clemency or whatever, you'll get your freedom in exchange for fighting in combat for a year. Now, of course, they were going into horrific combat with terrible leadership and very little training, and they were getting slaughtered. And so most of them didn't survive, from what I can tell, but some did. And some of them actually got their freedom. And frankly, bad leadership, bad training, bad discipline, horrendous circumstances didn't make them better human beings or better citizens going back into Russian society. And they've kind of, many of them have gone back to their same old ways. In fact, if anything, they're more brutal and violent than they were before they went into prison. So that's a big issue. Now, drone production on the Russian side has been growing, but there are a lot of indicators out there that it will soon be maxed out. Although they could get to a point where they're actually, they say in November, you could see 2,000 Shahed drones being launched on a night, to give you an idea of how big that is. And right now, I think the biggest we've seen is like maybe 600 to 700 drones on a really big night. But we'll see if that's sustainable. Western pressure is growing. Europeans are more unified than they've ever been before. Europe is now putting up money to buy U.S. weapons to go in. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, that Europe's putting up money to defend Europe. And also, you have to look at why did Putin start this war to begin with? Because Russia was failing. The Russian economy was failing. The Russian state was failing. He had to do something, so he tried to externalize it by taking land somewhere else. The problem, why was the Russian state failing? Because he was an autocrat. He was about a command economy. He was about, you know, cronyism and corruption. And none of that is what you see in a free economy that spurs innovation. And so the economy kept getting worse and worse. The society kept getting worse and worse. So he tried to externalize it, but the irony is that what he was doing with post-Soviet Union Russia is the same thing that is going to undo or is undoing Russia. In other words, he's a Soviet creation. He's a communist creation, if you will, but he's a Soviet creation. And he's doing the only thing he knows, and it has set the seeds for the political economic failure of Russia again. Anyway, much to think about, much to consider. Obviously, I have some strong feelings about this, and I hear a lot of people, they seem to do a Monday night football post-game rundown. They say, oh, the Russians are making advances on the battlefield. Well, if they were making advances on the battlefield, that would be a game that we saw nobody score a touchdown because they're simply not moving down the field in any significant way. And they're taking horrendous losses while they do it. And that's the difference between a football game and war. In a football game, you can get knocked down, you get up, and you're right back in the game. In war, when those troops get knocked down, for the most part, most of them don't get back up right away. Most of them never get back up. And there isn't an unlimited amount of troops. And that is part of the Russian myth, that they always have an unlimited amount of troops, and they simply don't. And that's one of the things that Russia's running into. Thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for listening to me cover all these different things I did. Please go to stratpodcast.com. You can go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kempfer TV, or you can go to my website, or you can go to any of the things. Of course, however you're getting this, Strat is one of the many platforms it's on. So thanks for listening, and we'll have one out next week.